I'll make sure this one machine works too.
People kind of like this down in the audience.
Senate Judiciary Committee, Wednesday, May 22nd, 1991, 5 p.m.
In Lincoln City, we've represented the industry operators for several years, and were involved in registering some of the first people under the 1985 legislation. This amendment came as a surprise to us, but when we found out about it, we were working with Mr. Mayfield was very cooperative and working with us to come up with something that the industry could support. And by and large, the industry has.
So are you in disagreement with the Dash 4 amendments, or are you just you're offering an additional one?
Offering an additional one. So, yes, we can support the
Dash 4.
Dash 4.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful to get that on the record. So why don't you go ahead, please, and either comment on the Dash 4 plus your 5 or just the 5, whichever you care to do.
We would just support the Dash 4. There was a lot of work that went into that. There was a question by Senator Springer on the fee interest. That was one of the provisions that would have been almost impossible for most of the Oregon operators that we represent to comply with. First of all, there was no definition of the fee interest, and many of our operators have purchased some small, some larger campgrounds on land sale contracts. As you know, land sale contracts, our people would be the equitable owner, not the legal owner. They simply wouldn't even have the power to provide for fee interest. Some of them are leased. They certainly wouldn't have that power. So there were all kinds of problems with the fee interest. And basically, the Real Estate Commissioner's Office had indicated finally then what they wanted to solve, the problems they wanted to solve, and that was some bankruptcies over the last few years that had left some people, presumably, without campgrounds. And I think the amendments that were put together solves those problems. So we can support the legislation with those amendments. We have Dash 5, proposed amendment, that is an amendment to page 7. It's on page 7, section 10, subsection 2. And Mr. Mayfield's hand-engrossed version, whatever it would be easiest for you to look at.
We'll just look at Mayfield's.
Okay.
Figure out when it fits.
That would be on his page 9 at the bottom right-hand corner. Okay. Page 9. Section 10, subsection 2.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that provision, the records of the sale of membership camping contracts shall be subject to inspection, is something obviously that that they had the provision for in the timeshare and subdivision law. We didn't have a problem with that legislation, that clause as it reads. Except that we were concerned that our operators, membership campground operators, have invested a substantial amount of money in marketing their projects, in coming up with customer lists, contract members. They have thousands and thousands of members. These members do not want their names, addresses, and telephone numbers being subject to being purchased, for instance, from the Real Estate Commissioner's Office. The Real Estate Commissioner's Office believes that any information they get would be open to public inspection. The public would have access to those lists. Our amendment would make that make any of that information, although the commissioner would have full access to the information would not be subject to public disclosure. It would be an exemption. There is an exemption in the Chapter 192 right now for trade secrets, and we believe that the information that we're concerned with constitutes trade secrets. The problem is that unless the real estate commissioner would have that legislation there, as we understand it right now, the Attorney General's office has ruled that any information that they have is open to the public. The public can't have that information. And without this particular amendment, our operators, the information that they've spent literally millions of dollars.
What if we say you can't use it for commercial purposes?
That would help. That would help. Our concern would still be.
I understand.
Okay.
Go ahead, please finish. Okay. Tell us what the rest of the concern would be.
The concern there would be that that information would be available to any other person, any other agency that may be trying to gather that information for whatever reason, without any seemingly legitimate concern or purpose. There's no notification requirement right now to the operators that information would be available. That's the problem with the public records law right now.
Okay, do they generally what's the experience in timeshares and those kinds of things? Do you have people searching around to find out who's got membership, who's got ownership in timeshares, and where, and whether they put them on lists and advertise or do whatever they do?
I don't know. I don't know that industry. But in fact, in this particular industry, because of the industry and because of the number of people that are contacted and the amount of money that's invested in it, there are people doing that. But you know, the commercial side of it is one part, one aspect of it. The other aspect is the concern that any other agency could obtain that information without contacting the operator, without having necessarily the
what
proper
agency
concern.
Are you concerned about? Department of Revenue? What other agency you think might be interested in?
Justice Support Division. Child support
can have that probably anyway.
Those agencies, if they went to court, could probably obtain that information, even if it was exempt under the statute, under the public interest. Okay.
Yeah, I think we'll do a little more research and be back in touch with you and see where we are with it, given our little diatribe this afternoon. Let's hear, are there further questions for Mr. Kula from the committee members? Bill.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kula, you're concerned about membership lists, am I correct?
Yes.
And yet your amendment would exempt all information and records sent to the real estate division, is that correct, agency?
Yes, because our concern, Mr. Taylor, is that if the real estate commissioner only has, one or two contracts, a little bit of information, it's not going to be of value commercially or to another agency. The problem is if the real estate commissioner, for some reason, and right now they have never asked for that, is a full list of all of the members, and names, addresses, telephone numbers, membership list, that type of thing. They haven't asked for it yet.
Thank you. We're going to ask the other people what kind of experience they've had in other states in terms of this whole issue, too. So let's see if Mr. Martin can shed any light on that.
Madam Chairman, fellow senators, I'm John Martin. I'm here representing Leisure Time Resorts of America, which is a Washington corporation registered with the state of Oregon because we have marketed here. We're in a little different situation than all of the other companies that have been involved that have testified so far, in the fact that we do not own a resort, but we are registered. We do have 826 members, which is roughly, that reside in Oregon, which is roughly 10% of our total membership base. We presently own 7 resorts in Washington and are actively seeking one or more resorts in the state of Oregon. The to, so that I don't get redundant with what's already been said, I am here testifying, and I'm also president of the Washington State Industry Association. I'm here in support of the B4 amendments and the bill with the amendments included. I agree with the rest of the industry that we would have to oppose the bill as it passed the House. I cannot stress strongly enough that if the bill as it passed the House passes, you've completely defeated the purpose of the entire intent of the bill, which is to protect consumers. The same thing would happen here that has happened essentially in the state of Wisconsin, that every person, no matter which company that they have, well, I shouldn't say which company, but by far the majority, would not survive in the industry. I know our particular company, we would cease looking for a resort in Oregon. Our Oregon members are looking forward to
it. Okay, we're not talking about that old bill anymore.
Okay. Okay, the new bill with the amendments, very strongly support it. In regards to B5 with this amendment, I have had personal experience with this type of thing. I understand the concern that it addresses. And the main thing that is the proprietary interest in the membership list. This is a thing that is very frightful to us. And it's been frightful throughout the entire United States. I've had dealings with other states as well. I'm ashamed to say that within our industry, some past practices have proven that there are some very great efforts made by some competitors and some people in the industry to gain a competitor's membership list. They will put people, plants on the payroll to try to get membership lists. We have been offered, our company has been offered one of the major companies in the industry's membership list for $10,000 so that we could use it for our marketing purposes. There are some real horror stories out there in what's going, and we get exceedingly protective over them because there are literally millions of dollars invested in those lists. And that's the main concern. To my knowledge, I have never known any public agency to abuse their rights to the access of this. But the fear is that if somebody inadvertently, unfortunately, the damage would be done before we'd even hear about it. Things work very, very quickly. And the list could be out there, it could be in use, and then the locking the door after the horse is stolen type thing.
Okay, well, that's our only concern. Take a look at narrowing this down. We appreciate your, you know, if the main concern is membership lists, then maybe we can sort of revisit that with Bill, with Mr. Taylor, and we'll work with Kula and company and see what we can do with that. Appreciate your comments. Other questions from committee members? Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. We have a quorum. Before we lose a quorum, we have, let me find my sheet with the little blues. Let's take up 2250. In a work session. That's the bill that we've passed out once before, brought back. It has conflict amendments in it, and that's why we have them before us.
Thank you.
This is not relevant subject matter to anything except legislative counsel. The chair would move the -2 amendments to 2250. This bill happens to be the Mannix bill, which talked about certified mail. And so what we had, we passed that out, brought it back to committee, and it's here to sort of do legislative counsel's bidding to add these conflict amendments, which other bills are before us dealing with the certified mail. So are there objections to the chair's motion to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 2250? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, I think the bill is back, ready to go. I would accept the motion.
So I move House Bill 2250 as amended back for the fourth due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Hill has moved House Bill 2250 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. House Bill 2530. I think we probably have a... We'll see how we do on that one. I didn't hear any. Bill, this one has to do with contract bids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2530 was last before the committee on May 10th. It's sponsored by Representative Shipwreck and Walden, Representative Mannix. It allows the losing bidder of a construction project to sue the winning bidder for 10% of the losing bidder's bid or $5,000, whichever is greater, if the winning bidder intentionally fails to register with the state authorities as a contractor, pay prevailing wages, workers' compensation, unemployment, or withholding taxes. However, the losing bidder cannot recover if the winning bidder can show that the losing bidder also failed to register with the state authorities and do the same thing.
Okay. We have any...
No amendments, Madam Chair.
No amendments. Anyone have a problem with this bill?
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 2530 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Hill, move House Bill 2530 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay. What do we have anything else, a work session that we need to have our little quorum for? Let's take up 1212. We can do that, right? Senate Bill 1212. This bill came to us in Ways and Means.
It's going to Ways and Means.
And going back to Ways and Means. That's why I want to get these Senate bills out of their way here. And then next bill up will be House Bill 2594, the vaccine bill. And then we will take House Bill 3055. Not wake you late till midnight, but.
Thank you.
Do you take advantage of our quorum to move, because people need to go. Okay. Bill Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill, as you said, comes from Ways and Means, and was put together by the Department of Motor Vehicles. It was last before us on May 3rd, and you have in front of you an engrossed version of the bill. And I believe to the dash four amendments. Basically, this bill does two main things. Where you have had a criminal proceedings and the person has been found guilty, and they'd be found guilty under the higher standard, the criminal standard, when you now had that person coming before the Department of Motor Vehicles for a hearing, whether to the person's license should be removed, you would not have to go through a full-blown hearing, but you would have a truncated hearing and where the Department of Motor Vehicles would determine whether, in fact, you were the person that was before the criminal court and whether, in fact, you had received notice from the court. And I think that's basically the extent of the hearing. The other thing is, on certain proceedings, and I, top of my head, I don't remember what they were, requires DMV hearings to be conducted within 100 miles of the petitioner's residence or the county in which the petitioner resides. That's the other change, major change.
Okay. The amendments are, we have gathered up amendments which basically take out the habitual offender, right? That's my recollection, out of this procedure. Yeah.
I'm not sure, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think Joe Plank would be better.
I think I'm sure. So you have, that's basically what the amendments do, among other things, but the biggest one is to remove, not tamper with the habitual vendor.
Madam Chair, Joe Plank with the Motor Vehicles Division, that's correct.
Okay, the committee have any other comments, questions, issues? Do you recall the debate on this?
Yes, I
We had some concerns that people, that consolidating on a regional level, those hearings would make people drive within 100 miles, but basically they said they already have that authority for the other hearings that they do. They haven't abused it, haven't made people drive around the country, so. Senator Brockman, what do you think about this bill? You okay?
Well, I was till I saw this new mittful of amendments. Well, but apparently they don't, in spite of their size, they don't do a great deal more than what the measure was intended to do in the first place, huh?
Why don't you just raise it, just kind of go through a little bit.
Madam Chair, Senator Brockman, the -4 amendments are the ones that we would ask to be adopted this evening. The 1s, 2s, and 3s have been all combined into the -4s, which is one of the reasons why they look as large as they do.
No, I'm okay.
Okay. Okay, then Senator Brockman moves the -4 amendments.
I said I was okay.
Yeah. Are there objections?
Joan offered to write my carrying speech.
Sure. He knows when to aggressively volunteer. Are there objections to adopting the -4 amendments? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Senator Brockman then moves Senate Bill 1212. Actually, we'll reserve that for you when it comes out of Ways and Means.
Yeah, that's right.
Actually,
gotta go to Ways and Means.
You don't even have to carry it. Senate Bill 1212 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass. That, I guess that's what we do. Okay.
That's my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay. Are there further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay. Do we have anything else, Bill, that we can quickly need to do while we have everybody here and attended for? Okay. Let's go then to House Bill 2594. And we have Jim Lace and Jim Carlson are here, I guess, sponsors of this bill. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Medical Association, and with me tonight is Dr. Jim Lace, who's a pediatrician in private practice here in Salem. Some of you might recall this particular piece of legislation from last session. It is very similar to a bill that was passed out of Senate Judiciary Committee and through the Senate, but did not receive timely action on the House side and thus did not make it all the way through the process. What you have in front of you tonight in the engrossed version of the bill represents compromise amendments that were reached between the Medical Association and the Trial Lawyers Association on the House side. There is one area of the bill that is still under contention, though, and that is on the amount of the cap on damages that you'll find in the bill. And excuse me just a second, find appropriate section. Section 4, down on line 42 in the bill, it currently reads $250,000, which is consistent with the amount in the federal program. I'm going to ask Dr. Lace now to speak to the substance and the content of the bill, and then we'll be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay. Dr. Lace.
Okay. Thank you. I'm Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem, Oregon. I'm the past president of the Oregon Pediatric Society and a member of the Oregon Medical Association. This bill is addressing the issue of under-immunization of children in the state of Oregon as one problem. In 1986, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act was passed. This was in response to the threatened and actual unavailability of vaccines that the manufacturers had brought up and said, we're not going to put up with the liability anymore. and they actually stopped making the vaccine. We ran out of vaccines for a while. The American Academy of Pediatrics went to the legislature on the federal level and asked, could there be something done? And this National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act was passed. And what this did was basically assume that there are going to be some injuries that arise from the administration of these vaccines. Since all 50 states require these vaccines for school entry, it seemed unfair that that if there was going to be some injury to a mandated medical procedure, that there should not be some recourse to it. And this was set up as, I guess, as one of the first or the only product liability laws to pass the on a federal level. What this basically does in a nutshell is that every time a child receives a vaccine in our office or at the health department in their county or in the city, a surcharge is added on to the cost of that vaccine that they pay. To give you an idea how much the surcharge is for the DPT vaccine, it may be as much as $11 or $12 per shot. What this money does is go to fund the Vaccine Injury Act on the federal level so that there's money in the system supposedly to run it. And the money that we all pay, it comes either on a private level or it can come from the state level. The state has already contracted out for a biennium, for example, to provide X amount of vaccines to the health department. And the state will pay the $400,000 already into that system to help fund that system. So irregardless of whether we participate in it on this with this House bill, we're already participating in it on a financial level. The intent of this bill was to sort of short-circuit the legal system and to award to injured patient money or monetary value that would hopefully be commensurate with the needs of that child. And the basic tenets of this would be that for death of the child or for pain and suffering, that there would be a cap of $250,000. If a child was injured and still lived and lived for every period of time, also the child's lost income and medical expenses would be covered on the federal level. One of the problems with the federal legislation was that it addressed the manufacturer's liability and did not really address the liability associated with the administration of the vaccine, i.e. the private doctor or the health division or anybody else that administers the vaccine. And it was felt that we needed to address the system in a different manner. This bill was drafted in response to that. It's of note that the National Trial Lawyers Association did not go on record as opposing the National Injury Childhood Vaccine Act. The just to make sure everybody's clear, in Oregon there are only four state-mandated medical procedures, and these only concern children. Each newborn has to get eye prophylaxis against gonorrhea. Each newborn has to receive a PKU screen, and each child has to receive their vaccinations. In the state, and there's a list of the vaccines, the diphtheria, the tetanus, the whooping cough, the polio, measles, rubella, and mumps. And what we would like to do is to make sure that the basically the administration of these vaccines is done in a careful manner, that patients are informed of their of the potential risks of these vaccines, that there's a standardized procedure for doing this, that the materials are standardized, and that everybody is required to do this basically, and also that the liability associated that with the administration of those vaccines is done in an equitable manner, so that if the child receives the vaccine at the health division, at the health department here in Marion County, for example, that and if there's an adverse reaction to the vaccine, that or if they receive it in my office, for example, or some other physician's office in the state, that their liability is going to be on the same ground, and that for some reason the private doctors may not be looked on as a deep pocket, for example, that we're all on the same ground. Just to remind you, one other quick fact, right now in the state of Oregon, we're running at about a 55% immunization rate. So it means that 45 to 50% of our children are unimmunized properly. They get caught up by the time they get to school because they can't enter school. But in that first 5 years, we're one of the worst states in the union right now. And this is, like I said, one way to address this problem. That's not going to be the only way to address the problem. There has to be better public education and other outreach programs.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions?
Madam Chair, I had one final point I was going to add.
Okay, sir, have you have a question?
No, simply deja vu, because I voted against the mandating of vaccinations just for this reason, the adverse reactions.
Madam Chair, the one final point I was going to make was that the bill in its current form now is very similar to the minority report that came out last session, was supported by the trial lawyers, in that we have removed the manufacturers from the bill, and that the cap on damages remains at $250,000, as it did last session in both the committee bill and in the minority report bill that came out.
You, by removing the manufacturers, the committee members, you mean you haven't...
The manufacturers...
...subjected them to this kind of...
They will not receive any liability protections at all in this legislation. The manufacturers will not. That was the result of some compromise amendments that the trial lawyers and the OMA agreed to on the House side.
Okay. So we're just now talking about whether the 250 corresponds to the... federal,
yeah,
and on administrators.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, we feel that it's important that the cap at the state level correspond to what's there.